Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to this Teneo Insights call. Lockdown 3 has sometimes sounded and felt like the title of a very bad movie sequel, but the light at the end of the tunnel appears clear, and we're making slow progress towards it with deliberate steps. Schools went back on Monday. In a month, we should be able to eat outside and start visiting more shops. And on top of that, the vaccine program has been a success. It's not all been plain sailing, though. This week, a major row broke out about the government offering NHS workers a 1% pay rise. There are fears about what will happen to unemployment and many businesses when the life support system of the furlough scheme is switched off, and the test and trace scheme was revealed to have cost a whopping £37 billion, with some claiming it's had nearly zero effect. As things stand, though, the June the 21st date for a complete end of the lockdown looks to be achievable. So naturally, minds are turning to questions like, is the government doing enough to ensure the economy is as robust as it can be? Have we understood the damage that's been done and what can be done to fix it? Have we become more tribal, more divided than ever? And crucially for this audience, what is the role of business in all of this? To help answer those questions, we've got another great panel. Annalise Dodds is the Shadow Chancellor. We'll be asking her to set out her party's vision for a post-COVID Britain. Stephanie Flanders is the former BBC Economics Editor. After a stint at JP Morgan, she returned to journalism and is now the head of Bloomberg Economics. And Deborah Mattinson is a founder of Britain Thinks. She'll be providing fascinating insights from her polling and focus groups. But before we get to them, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for outside broadcast or publication. Annalise, I'm going to start with you first. Thanks for taking the time to join us. I know quite how busy you are. Opposition is like a really tough gig at the best of times, but during coronavirus, it seems to have been particularly hard. I want you just to give us an opportunity to make your pitch straight to business, and nothing more difficult question than that. So do you want to set out where you think Labour Party is with business and why they should listen to you?
Yes, absolutely. And first of all, it's such a pleasure to be with you all today. Thanks very much indeed for the invitation. Obviously, we're coming up now to a whole year since I became Shadow Chancellor. And in that time, we've seen government lock down whole sections of our economy. It spent unimaginable sums, previously unimaginable sums, keeping our businesses afloat. And we've become used, of course, to virtual sessions of everything, virtual sessions of Parliament, virtual voting, and as today, having to build relationships with key stakeholders virtually as well. I have to say the world's seen a lot more of the inside of my house than I ever would have anticipated previously. But of course, throughout that first year when I've been in position, you know, Labour's always sought to be a constructive opposition. We've backed government on the big calls when they've got them right, but we've also called government out when we felt things have been going wrong. The stakes have been very high and it would have been irresponsible for us not to. Now that, as you said, the vaccine is being rolled out and restrictions have started to lift, our thoughts are turning to recovery, as you said. And there is here a very clear difference between Labour's approach and that of the Conservatives. And I think we can see this really embodied in the choices taken in the budget last week. We had much anticipated and long called for short-term moves. So on the furlough scheme, business rates, VAT and grants, many businesses will welcome these as Labour did, although we wondered why they had to wait until March the 3rd. But we didn't have that long-term plan to stimulate our recovery. We didn't have a plan to help the unemployed back into work. We didn't have a sense of urgency in accelerating public investment to crowd in private investment. In fact, we saw the cutting of planned capital spending since last March. The major innovation, the rabbit out of the hat that people will be very well aware of, was the super deduction, a necessary counterpoint to the rise in corporation tax taking place in 2 years' time. But as the OBR has shown, this is likely to mainly move investment around rather than stimulating new investment. And in the longer term, we've seen the industrial strategy officially archived and replaced with 8 free ports and a levelling up fund. It doesn't feel strategic or ambitious. And because there isn't that long-term plan, forecasts are worryingly anemic, actually. That perhaps is why we seem to see a focus from government on spending cuts and tax, additional tax to stabilize the public finances rather than growth. And I disagree with that choice. A Labour budget would have gone all out for growth, no immediate tax rises, so that we would keep demand as high as possible. We would have accelerated capital spending, £30 billion worth of it, to kickstart the creation of additional jobs. We also would have expanded very significantly the startup loan scheme to get new entrepreneurs into business. And we would have promised our young people support within 6 months rather than the weak offer that's there at the moment. But beyond that, above all, we take a strategic long-term approach to the economy, providing much clearer forward guidance to businesses about policy-making decisions. And from many businesses that I've spoken to in the last year, one of the things that's come up time and time again is that need for certainty for a plan. You know, I come from a small business background myself. My dad was a small businessman. You know, I know exactly what it's like when there is such uncertainty in the business environment, and we really need to be countering that right now with that long-term strategy. I want our businesses to have the confidence they need so they can be taking on additional staff. I want the Labour Party to be working with all of you as businesses to build that new partnership so we can have that long-term approach. And I think it's really important we expect more of each other. You know, over the last few years, I think that very often businesses come to expect less of government and politicians, and government and politicians have often come to expect less of business. Well, we've got to change that. We've got to be ambitious for our country. And, you know, that does start with conversations like this. You know, my door's always open. I want to hear from the businesses on this call, not just now, but actually into the future as well, about how we can have that long-term, ambitious, strategic plan for our country's economy. Thank you.
Come to you next. We're not too far away from the budget, a few days after the budget. A couple of big things have come clear after it. Lots of debate about, you know, whether or not a corporation tax should have gone up, fears that inflation is going to return to the economy and that that might jack up interest rates and that's going to cause huge problems in the future. Give us your economist assessment of where we are at the moment, and particularly with a lens on where business is.
I think you know, the direction of travel is good, at least on the economic activity front, even if the starting point is still pretty bad. So I think I've mentioned on this call before, we have Bloomberg Economics, we've got economists, 30 economists doing research, as well as all the sort of good old economic reporters. And we come up with these kind of high frequency indicators that we've used for the last year now, as we realized that all of the traditional data was just way too out of date as we saw the pandemic having its effect. And if you look at that now across the sort of major economies, the UK has still got one of the lower levels of activity relative to pre-pandemic. This is just in terms of, we're also worse off in GDP terms, but this is also just in terms of the amount of, you know, those Google mobility data, the whatever it is, people shopping, anything like that. But understandably, because we're still in lockdown, we are at, I think, if you look at the latest one, we're around 50% of the activity level that we were at the beginning of last year. And if you think of the likes of Japan or even Spain, are now, because they have sort of broadly missed this second or third lockdown phase, they are back to more like 70 or 80%. So we're in a deeper hole economically than many other countries, though we have bought ourselves possibly a brisker, earlier recovery in the next few months than many countries in Europe, because of this really very impressive rollout of vaccines. So I think there is some optimism on the short term around that. We have also a big, one of the things that is making the Bank of England think a little bit in the short term about inflation is that we have this sort of sleeping giant of all these excess savings sitting on household bank accounts. The people who haven't lost their jobs, who obviously would have had to go into their savings, have not been spending as they expected and are now desperate to go out and spend it on holidays, whatever it is. We reckon there's at least £120 billion of extra savings sitting in people's bank accounts. And that how that is spent, how quickly that's spent, what it's spent on is going to have a big role in the recovery. But you might see a sort of short-term spike in inflation as a result of that. And you might even be great, glad to see it if hairdressers and other people are trying to get back some of what they've lost in this kind of spur of activity. So, you know, that's all quite positive. But as I said, the starting point is still a deep hole, which we have made ourselves a bit deeper for ourselves with Brexit and what we can see, you know, all the kind of microeconomic friction that's coming out of that was entirely predicted from the terms of that trade deal and from just the fact of Brexit itself making us have a less open relationship with our nearest trading partner. That was just always, whatever you think about Brexit, that was always going to be what we'd be dealing with now. So we've added that. So we probably by the end of this year, even if we have a faster recovery, there will be a bigger hole in our economy, if you like, than many of our trading partners. You mentioned the budget. I mean, I think there's, you know, if the economy is sort of looking quite good short term, but we're conscious of quite a deep hole to climb out of longer term and question marks about where we are, where we're going. I think the same was really evident in the budget. And I have a feeling that I'll be making from an economic standpoint some of the same kind of points or implicit critiques of the government as Annalise. And then we'll hear from Deborah that actually they're not paying any price for these failings at all. But I do think it's striking that you saw, you know, the upfront generosity to firms and individuals that we definitely needed to see. The extension of the furlough, all of these things that I think will support that recovery and hopefully have, you know, we want that excess savings to be suppressed spending to burst into the economy and actually keep a lid on suppressed unemployment, you know, have when the furlough goes away, not find that millions, potentially millions, certainly hundreds of thousands of those furloughed jobs are actually no longer viable. And I think the Chancellor has done good things in the short term to try and minimise that, to make sure that we do have hopefully not a kind of big spike in unemployment. But if you look beyond this immediate support also for firms and the corporation tax, the extraordinary investment incentives, which is going to be very strong for the next couple of years, beyond that is actually a very parsimonious view of the budget. No, as the OBR pointed out, no additional public spending as a result of COVID built in after next year, which is a very brave thing to do and suggests a quite austere vision for the next few years. I too was struck, maybe because I've spent some time working with Greater Manchester on their regional industrial strategy, which was part of which was supposed to be linked up with the national industrial strategy, to have dumped that whole network of activity that people have invested a lot of time in, and not just civil servants, but businesses, I thought was extraordinary from a government that says it wants to carve out a new industrial future for us. So I do think there's these quite, there's the headline stuff around the corporation tax, but also in the nitty gritty, some real, you know, you're just wondering what the direction is coming from this government. What do they see? We just this morning, Bloomberg, have an interview with John Glenn, the economic secretary of the Treasury, talking about dramatic reform of capital markets to help the city attract more, you know, not just what we've seen recently about fintech and IPOs, but more broadly have a more aggressive way to build up the city. That's great, but all the polling we see suggests that far fewer financiers now see London as the leading global financial hub. In 2019, it was over half in the same poll. Now it's about 31% see the UK as the leading financial hub. In 2 years, to have had the US now up to 60% of people thinking that that's really the most important financial centre in the world, quite significant. So a lack of clarity makes me worry about the medium term, even though I think the short term is looking quite positive.
Thanks, Stephanie. I just draw everybody's attention to the Q&A function at the side of the screen. We've got one question coming already, but please feel free to put some questions in there and I'll put them to the panel. Deborah, I'm going to come to you next. You always have a fascinating job, but it's particularly interesting at the moment and seeing how people's attitudes are changing. I was just struck listening to Annalise and Stephanie, you know, objectively, there are a lot of problems, there are a lot of issues, some government missteps along the way, and yet they seem to be doing okay. We seem to be fed a diet of polls recently saying the government's doing well in the polls, that kind of thing. Is that right? Is that accurate, despite all the problems that they seem to be forging ahead?
Yes and no, I think, is the answer to that. I mean, I think the first thing to note, and it is why my job is so interesting at the moment, as you say, is how very, very volatile the public mood is. So thinking particularly about people's reaction to the coronavirus crisis, we've been tracking that for a year now in some depth. And we've seen people go from sort of fear and shock through to boredom, through to hope, then boredom again. And one of the most interesting things we did in a focus group was to ask people to bring along things that symbolize lockdown one versus lockdown two. And the best example was one guy who, for lockdown one, brought along a pair of trainers. He'd been really determined to take up jogging and really get into running in lockdown one. Lockdown two, it was a pair of slippers. Sod it, I'm just sitting in front of the telly, that's it. So then people moved into a different mindset, which was actually terror. People were really scared at the beginning of this year. We found in one of our polls that 6 out of 10 said that they were more personally threatened by COVID at that point, that was in early January, than they had ever been before. And now we're seeing people a little bit hopeful again. We divided the population into three groups, strugglers, thrivers, and copers. And what we found through this period was that the thrivers disappeared. People stopped feeling that they were thriving through this. There were some people who said, you know what, it's quite good, there are some good things. People stopped saying that. Coping was business as usual. Coping was the very best that you could hope for. But, you know, the vaccine program has, you know, given people a little bit of hope. 6 out of 10 of us think that the vaccine program is better here than anywhere else. But nonetheless, it is a roller coaster, and it's one that's hit some groups much harder than others. And I think it's really worth focusing on that briefly. It's exposed a lot of existing inequalities, and people are very aware of that, be that geography, be it how rich you are, be it gender. We're just doing a piece of work which we're launching next week with Mumsnet that shows how much harder, reflects the ONS data, actually it was published yesterday, how much harder it is for women than men. And 6 out of 10 say lockdown's been harder for women. 73% of women, only 55% of men think that. And 61% of people feel more stressed. 77% of women feel more stressed. So it's a roller coaster. And I think that in answer to your initial question, Craig, that is reflected in very fluid political attitudes. So in recent months, we've seen the polls absolutely flip-flop around. So, you know, we've moved from what, let's face it, was Labour's biggest defeat since 1935 to Labour under new leadership actually pulling ahead for a few months. And now we're seeing the Tories creeping back. And the most recent poll, which I think is probably the one you were referring to, showing a pretty healthy 13-point lead. But it's very hard to see where that's going to go, because I think the public is so volatile, really, you know, all bets are off actually at the moment. And in fact, talking of bets, I noticed on the political betting website that most punters are actually now not predicting a Tory victory at the next election, which I thought was fascinating. I mean, what do they know? But anyway, we're seeing quite strong public support for the budget, as Stephanie suggested. But most of the polling was done before what I'm calling the misstep. I don't know if it was a misstep. I don't know if that's the right way to describe it. But before the story about nurses' pay emerged, and I think, you know, we'll perhaps come on and talk more about that, but that is not very well supported. And I think we'll see that reflected. One constant through this period of turbulence is how divided we are as a country. And Brexit first exposed that. COVID then brought us together. But it seems now that we're back to being as divided as ever we were. And I think that I wanted to talk briefly about the latest royal story. I wouldn't normally, but I think it's just so interesting because it really evidences that, I think. And half of us expect now that the country will be more divided in the next decade than united. And that is a divide that reflects on age, social class, geography. It's basically a values divide. And that interview, hit on those same touch points, the same sort of fault lines. So most side with the Queen, who is the most popular royal in Britain, although in Britain Think's most recent survey of leadership, she's less popular actually than Marcus Rashford as a leader, but still. If you ask if you have sympathy for Harry and Meghan, 29% say yes and 56% no. But when you look at age, 18 to 34 year olds have 59% saying yes, they're sympathetic with Harry and Meghan, and just 20% saying no, while 65 pluses literally turns that on its head. So 13% saying yes, I have sympathy with them, and 79% saying no. So I think we are and remain a very divided nation. Finally, I just wanted to touch on where all that gets us to for the future and what kind of appetite there is for change. And that's yet another thing that we're divided about, because, you know, can we change for the better? 37% say yes, 38% say no, and the remain don't know. What we find at first sight is that people want to see a return to normal. 6 out of 10 say they want that. But the desire for the new normal is really apparent and undercuts a lot of the, you know, the qualitative work that we do where we look in more depth. But in the polling, going back to that nurses' pay point, 83% tell us that they want to see essential workers paid more and treated better. And the NHS is top of people's wish lists for post-COVID priorities. So definitely at best a misstep there. 89% say they want to see the recovery affecting the whole country, not just London. And that was how we worded it, so quite strong. 55% of mums in our Mumsnet poll that we'll be releasing next week want politicians to focus on a fairer, kinder society, not just economic recovery. And 7 out of 10 are optimistic about the increased levels of community spirit as the pandemic has encouraged us all to think about the things that really matter. And in that sense, it's a sort of back to basics story. And perhaps I'll just end with one thing that for me sums up the mood at the moment. And this is one of our mums in the Mumsnet poll. And she said, there's been so much heartbreak. It would be fantastic to think that some good can come out of all of this tragedy, that we could move forward to a better place.
Thank you, Deborah. That was fascinating. As ever, there's loads in there. So let's move to the sort of questions section. Annalise, I just want to start with you. And I think you made a very good case for why Labour and business should talk to business and business should listen and engage. I think one of the questions people have is, like, not that long ago, Ed Miliband was leading the party and he was basically using Thomas Piketty as his sort of intellectual guru, talking about predatory capitalism and how we needed to get businesses sorted out. Then we went through the phase of Jeremy Corbyn, who seemed to sort of even accentuate that. And now much more of us, it feels almost slightly Gordon Brown, Blairite sort of attempt to say to the city, say to business, look, we're your friend, we can work with you. And I suppose that mostly came out during the corporation tax thing. So it's appeared at one stage that you might say that actually now is not the time to raise taxes on businesses, and then seem to shift on that. Help us understand that a bit more.
Sure, thanks very much, Craig. And actually, we were consistent on this and very much, I think, in line with both expert opinion, but also what businesses were saying to us that, you know, obviously there does need to be a conversation about the tax system for the future, and particularly on corporation tax rates. I mean, many people on this call will be aware that in the past, Labour has drawn attention to the fact that we've had those tax rate cuts, but we've not seen the investment that was then promised to be a result of those cuts. So we have for a long time actually wanted to see a fairer system around corporation tax, particularly when you compare that system to the business rates system, of course, which applies as a sunk cost to those businesses based in bricks and mortar. So, you know, we did want to see longer term reform, but we didn't want to see taxes imposed right now. And that is where there's a big difference, of course, between Labour and the Conservatives, because we are seeing, for example, additional taxes applied to households through council tax that's going up right now, 5% on households right now, really the worst time to be imposing that change when we need to be pushing demand up in the economy. And, you know, the UK is very, very different to other countries in the approach coming from government right now. We're not focusing on demand in that way, but also in having short-term cuts to public services as well, and in indeed having a real terms cut for our healthcare workers. So, you know, there are very, very different choices there. You know, I suppose I was a little frustrated that, you know, some of what Labour was saying about timing seemed to, for some people, get muddled up into a general principle. They're separate points, you know, that we need to focus on the recovery right now, and we do then need to have a fairer system for the future.
And just to pick up on that, though, So corporation tax is a tax on profits. And a lot of businesses actually have managed to do very well. You know, they've rarely been more profitable because they're not spending lots of money on office space and travel and entertainment, all that sort of thing. Why would it not be a good idea to just those who prospered during this just take a bit of a hit now?
Well, you know, some businesses have, but I think there's quite a varied picture, actually. I mean, if you think about, for example, some of the additional costs that have applied, you know, I don't think we should forget about those. We shouldn't be too glib around this. I mean, I would say actually that, you know, this relates to our general principle around economic support from the Labour Party, that, you know, very many of these support measures, they've not been well targeted. So, for example, with the business rates holiday, in Labour-run Wales, they decided from the beginning to target that support so that the very biggest essential retailers, for example, the very biggest supermarkets, that they wouldn't get that support from the beginning, that it would be focused instead on small businesses. That worked really effectively. We've not had that approach, of course, taking place in England. So, you know, rather than, I guess, always looking at the back end, the taxation system, of course, it is important, but we need to look at the front end as well. And, you know, not having that targeted approach from government, I think, has been really problematic. You know, we've seen whole groups of businesses missed out of support schemes. You know, think about owner directors, for example. And yet we've also then seen many of those schemes actually supporting, in some cases, businesses that probably didn't need to have that hand up and where we could have had a more targeted system from the beginning.
Thank you. That's helpful. Stephanie, another thing that's coming through, you touched on this, but Sean Ryan is asking a question on this, is about how worried we should be about inflation and what should be done to make sure it's no more than the short-term spike that you suggested it was. I mean, just to point it out, people are worried, really, not so much about the inflation, but the interest rate rises that may follow at a time when the government's borrowing spectacular sums of money. Stephanie, tell us why you're not quite as worried as some of the commentary in the papers is suggesting.
I mean, there's two things. There's sort of what we think is going to happen with inflation and then potentially the implications for government borrowing. I mean, just quickly, I think there's two different questions that are important. I think the second question is more important than the first. The one is, are we going to see inflation with a bit of supply bottlenecks and this sort of burst of spending at the end of June? I think the answer is yes, and I think the Bank of England is quite prepared to look through that, as they have done in the past. We've actually been quite successful in this country in a world of deflation at keeping our inflation rate to target. But there's a longer term question, which obviously lots of people in the financial markets ask themselves all the time, is, are we moving from a world where interest rates have just got lower and lower and lower, and the inflation rate has never posed a problem and has generally been too low, not too high, to a world in which those defaults have switched, and that we're gradually going to see interest rates rise over time, long term as well as short term. We're gradually going to see a kind of back to normal in terms of inflation. You know, I think that it is true, there's reasons to think medium term, if you look at global demographics, if you look at potentially what's happened, you know, with sort of peak globalization, if you like, you know, we're not going to have that sort of constant pressure on prices that comes from China and all its workers having entered the global labor force. You know, there's reasons to think that long term, we are going to be gradually moving to a higher interest rate, higher inflation world, at least, you know, more back to what we all might remember from 10 years ago or so. But there is, I don't think that there's any reason to think that is, you know, we shouldn't confuse that with what's going to happen this summer. And actually, with all the spare capacity in the economy that we're definitely going to have, and we can certainly see in the US underutilized bits of our economy, I don't think that sort of medium term we're going to see that kind of inflation push. On the cost of borrowing, there's lots of sort of finer points about this. One of the things that's always protected us, the UK, is that we have very long dated debt. So that massive debt stock, over £1 trillion, if you think of it in terms of, because it's like it's all on a long term fixed rate mortgage, effectively, if an interest rate went up because of inflation, how quickly would it affect our actual cost of borrowing? The answer is, or at least the cost of servicing all of that debt, it would take about 8 years for even half of that debt stock to have to be refinanced at this new higher rate. So if you're just sort of thinking about it as a mortgage holder, actually we're relatively protected by those very long-term fixed rate mortgages that we've effectively got on our debt. There's a third of the debt that now is owned by the Bank of England, and that means something slightly different, but that also protects us from interest rates, if you like, that interest rate rises that don't pertain to our economy. So one of the things that people are quite reasonably worried about is Biden is putting another $2 trillion into the US economy. That's pushing up government borrowing costs all around the world. Surely that's bad for us because our recovery is not going to get that $2 trillion. But the answer is not in our case, no, because the Bank of England's actually holding on to our lot of debt. And so our cost of borrowing is only going to go up if the Bank of England thinks it needs to because the UK is strong. So, sorry, it's a long answer, but I think that we are quite modulated. And the key thing to remember is if interest rates do start going up, it'll be for good reasons, by and large. It'll be because we're seeing a bit of inflation, which shows activity, and a bit of growth, and that is good for the other side of the government balance sheet, and probably better than the increase in government costs.
Okay, I think I'm reassured. Annalise, just want to have a quick word from you on that, and then I want to come to Deborah, but a quick word for you on inflation and interest rates.
Yes, I mean, I agreed very much with what Stephanie said. And I think broadly, I mean, obviously, these decisions are for the bank, and obviously we support an independent bank, clearly. But I do think that actually, kind of related to what Stephanie was saying about the potential for longer term inflation or otherwise, I mean, you look at what's happened to earnings in the UK economy over the last 10 years, we've had the longest squeeze on wages since Napoleonic times. You know, by my reckoning, about eight different generations have passed since we've had such a long squeeze on income. So the kind of mechanisms that, you know, back in the 70s and 80s we might have been focused on in terms of kind of locking in a higher rate of inflation into the economy, and, you know, what macroeconomic policy then would have been focused on around trying to deal with that so-called wage push inflation, you know, it take quite a long time before we got to that kind of a situation. I mean, of course, we have seen other developments recently. We've seen quite a large number of people leaving the UK economy, you know, our working population reducing from that point of view. It could mean a slightly tighter labour market. But I do think we've got quite a long way to go. And actually, related to what Stephanie said, I think it would be really positive. I mean, we really have seen, you know, very low living standards for people in the UK, quite large numbers of them. If we could be seeing that, you know, stronger wage growth, we really need to, I think, into the future. Of course, that'll be good for demand and lots of other things as well.
Well, that segues perfectly into my next question, which was about the 1% pay rise for the NHS. Deborah, I just wanted to start with you. Everybody took a real sort of sharp intake of breath where the government said it was going to give 1%, particularly after coronavirus. And a lot of people thought that sounds a bit crazy. What's going on here? Is there any polling evidence around it about if it's caused damage or how problematic it is?
Well, we haven't yet seen any polling that shows how it's going to impact on, you know, vote share. That, I guess, will come. But certainly we know from the polling that that is not a popular position. You know, asked specifically about that policy, we know that sort of 7 out of 10, I think it's 73% or something, don't support a 1% and would like to see more. I think actually that the figure I've seen that most surprised me, and in a way most sort of nails how unpopular this is that 53% say that they would support the nurses in strike action. Now, we are not a nation that's particularly fond of strikes, particularly, you know, from essential workers. So I think that shows the strength of feeling. And my guess is that, well, to be honest, I'd put money now that there will be some sort of U-turn fairly swiftly, because it seems to me one thing this government is actually quite good at is recognising when they've made a mistake and, you know, moving in the opposite direction. And I suspect that's what we'll see. I may be wrong. If we don't, then I think it will start to impact on their vote share. I think it's very unpopular.
Stephanie, just quickly from you. I mean, one of the arguments that was used by the government is basically that the state sector has got a lot of very stable, secure jobs at the moment. And actually, people in the state sector have actually had better pay than in the private sector at the moment. And actually, that's all working, and that's fine, and that's one of the reasons why they've just suggested this low number. Is that right?
I don't think it is. I mean, there has historically, when you take into account benefits and other things, it's true that public sector pay has on average been significantly better than private sector pay. But that was one of the justifications for a 5-year public sector wage freeze after 2010. So again, there was that brief period where, you know, if you were less likely to have lost your jobs in the public sector. So in that sense, you had done, you know, post global financial crisis, people had done relatively better. But then they had years and years of getting less than the private sector. And as Annelise says, actually, the private sector pay deals have not been so great either for the majority of the population. So it's kind of a race to the bottom on that front. But I think what it seemed to me was just a neuralgia about long-term spending commitment versus short-term ones, you know, looking very generous in the short term with things that are all one-offs, and then really this very tough outlook for beyond next year.
Annelise, this will not feel like an open goal for you. It's like natural territory for the Labour Party, the NHS and the Conservatives not necessarily doing what they should do with it. And yet we've seen in the last year the Marcus Rashford situation. We also saw what happened with A-levels and GCSEs and, you know, major mistakes. And it didn't seem to knock the government too much. What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, ultimately, in the middle of a global pandemic, we all need the government to succeed. We're all willing the government to succeed because we're in the middle of an enormous health and economic crisis. And obviously, you know, Labour did adopt that position of being a constructive opposition. And I'm certainly not going to make any apologies for that, because we did need to get those many mistakes fixed. I suppose one of the critical issues around the pay debate right now is that actually, you know, I'm really proud of what's being achieved with the vaccine deployment. You know, I'm speaking to you from Oxford. I know the incredible effort that's gone on here, and indeed the work of nurses at the Churchill Hospital down the road from me, who worked through every weekend to help with the trial. And actually that success for government, and, you know, again, delighted that the vaccine deployment is going very well. But, you know, that's because of the hard work of these nurses and of, you know, GPs and volunteers and local authorities, actually, a lot of the time. So I do think this will be a problem. And I would just say also that I think this idea that there's kind of separate sections of the UK population, you know, the private sector here and the public sector there, it just doesn't match with the reality of families, apart from anything else. You know, nurses will often be married to plumbers, and, you know, every variety of family imaginable will be present. So I think setting different groups against each other is not a sensible strategy.
Okay. I'm going to raise the dreaded B word, Brexit, which doesn't seem to get raised very much. And actually, Annelise, I noticed that you didn't, but it feels like it should be another open goal for the Labour Party at the moment. And Stephanie, I'll come to you first. It's a grumbling problem in the background. We're seeing issues, Northern Ireland, but also, you know, getting goods in and out of the country. And yet it's just not getting much attention. Is that because actually it's okay and we're just teething problems, or is it more serious than that?
They're not really teething problems. I mean, I think that's the point that many of these people are making, is that these are structural aspects of the trade deal, which was, you know, obviously the details of which were only known to businesses, you know, with almost hours to go. But it's a structural change in our relationship with Europe, which is not going to go away. But I do think the things that potentially would be fixable, the lack of engagement from the government, you know, for all of these business groups that might well have expected that they would get a hearing. But I can see, I think there's obviously a lot of politics around the Labour Party's response, and I can see that it's hard for them to always be jumping in to make more of these problems. But, you know, they are real. And I think that, you know, it goes to a little bit to what I was saying before. If you're going to sort of set yourself against the criticisms of the trade deal and say, no, this is what we wanted, because then you need to have an alternative plan for how we're going to go forward. And, you know, I was joking with someone the other day that, you know, we've had Brino was the thing that the Brexiteers were sort of worried that we might end up with, you know, Brexit in name only. And I think we got Cinco, we got sovereignty in pursuit of no clear objective. You know, we don't really, there's been no clarity about what the view is, except, as I said earlier, there's a there's this conversation around making the city more attractive to different kinds of fintech and others, but even that sits very oddly with the more interventionist sort of populist things that have been said on the industrial front. So it does seem like a bit of a mess, and with quite a lot of businesses just not being heard and having trouble.
Annalise, this feels like an area where you really, really could champion business and point out the problems, and that this is the weight around the economy at a time where it doesn't need it. And yet it feels that because you've got to win over a lot of people who supported Brexit, sort of don't want to hear it, and so you have to remain quiet on it. Is that fair?
Well, I certainly haven't remained quiet on it. I mean, ultimately, we have this deal that was concluded. That deal was presented and agreed by government and indeed with the rest of the EU. But we've got to make it work. And the problem is that we're not seeing that commitment from government to make it work right now. And, I very frequently do raise problems with the current approach. For many months, the fact that all the promised additional customs officials and agents weren't in place. I would say there's a challenge around this being provided with both media coverage and then impacting on the government, because a lot of it sounds very technical, but the reality of it is I've talked to small manufacturers, people who are producing tools, for example, part of a long supply chain, and they're literally spending evenings and weekends trying to get their heads around what the new measures are. They've got different responses from different countries that they're trying to trade with. This is a mess, and it is an avoidable mess, and government does need to take responsibility for it. And certainly Labour is trying to make sure that government is held to account on this. As I said, a lot of it will sound technical, but that doesn't make it any less important for those businesses who are really struggling, particularly the small ones, with all of this additional red tape.
Deborah, just very quickly, what's the polling showing on this? Are people heartily over it, or is there any rumblings that you're seeing?
No rumblings at all. I mean, we did a big piece of work in December, which is on our website if anybody's interested. And I mean, one of the most striking things we've been tracking views Brexit all the way through is how little they've changed, how entrenched people became in their position, as a Remainer or a Leaver, and how little they moved from that. But what they could all agree on in the end was that they just wanted it to stop. And, the work that I did in the Red Wall for the book that I wrote and that was published in September, I spent a lot of time there. I found that even people who had voted Remain had been very taken with Boris Johnson's promise to get Brexit done, because they just wanted it to go away. And right now they're not looking, they've got other things to worry about anyway, of course, with COVID, but that, they are not picking up any of the detail of this. And I think if the sort of technical problems that, Annalise was talking about just now, if we want the public to notice them, then they need to be shown what difference they will make to their lives. And the debate has to shift, I think, to re-engage people in a different way, because if it looks like you're just having the same old debate again and again, they will literally clap their hands over their ears and chant la la la. They're not going to be listening.
Okay, lots of questions about COP26, and one here which is basically saying, is there widespread support for the ambitions of COP, and is there an understanding among the public of some of the sacrifices we will need to make to meet it? So one sentence from you, Deborah, and then I'll come to Annalise and Stephanie. Is there an understanding of the pain, basically?
Yes, there's an anticipation of the pain and a reluctance to take it on at a personal level, because most people feel whatever little I do is inconsequential compared with what government might do or what companies might do. There is, however, broad support for the kind of, if you like, the global objective, but extreme willingness to unwillingness to sort of get on board and make personal sacrifice at this point. That might change.
Annalise, the government's trying to nail its colour to the mast and sees it as a real opportunity for the UK, and it's sort of put out its 10-point green plan. It says that it's willing to do what's necessary. Just give us an idea of where Labour is, and particularly try and address this point that a lot of people are going to experience a lot of change and a lot of difficulty if we are going to credibly get to net zero.
Well, they will experience difficulty if we don't see this process being managed in a muscular way, in a strategic way by government. And I think we can see that right now, actually, in aviation, for example, where there are obviously twin pressures, really extreme ones, obviously from COVID, then also environmental pressures. And the government's response has just been to stand back and not engage with industry and not have that strategic approach, to recognise that there will need to be change, but that ultimately it needs to be change that's supported and managed, you know, that isn't going to be hemorrhaging enormous numbers of jobs like we're seeing right now. So the critical question is actually, yeah, as I say, whether there's that strategy there. And I have to say, we find it very frustrating. You know, we strongly want that COP process to work, but we're not seeing opportunities right now to benefit our environment and benefit employment creation that other countries are taking on board, but the UK isn't. I mean, sadly, we have a position where, it won't come as a surprise to anyone on this call, that a lot of the UK's housing is of very poor quality when it comes to energy efficiency. You know, the one scheme that government had set up to deal with some of this, the Green Homes Grant, actually losing jobs. You know, we set out much more ambitious plans for delivering retrofitting, for example. That's something that you can quite quickly train people into delivering. And obviously it would help with some of that short-term bump of unemployment that we're likely to see in the months to come. So, you know, we really need to get beyond the kind of greenwash and green air here and actually focus on where there are win-wins, especially for employment, as well as for our environment.
And Stephanie, this gap between, you know, the telling everybody that you want to do something, you're going to do something, and the reality of it working on the ground, the impact on the economy, that kind of thing. We've discussed this, it's a huge topic, but a couple of sentences from you on that.
Yeah, I think the Green is a good example where you just find, it was really surprising. It's not surprising that the Chancellor didn't talk about Brexit in the budget, but I think to not also have had a significant chunk on those kind of, you know, obvious job creation opportunities that Annalisa was talking about, which actually the Prime Minister had talked about in the autumn when he produced the 10-point plan. It's a funny combination, which I mentioned at the start, of a willingness to be, of establishing a very kind of unconservative or sort of counter-brand reputation in the sort of upfront spending, but actually not seeming to want to think longer term or spend money now on things that actually have a longer term return rather than just keeping businesses afloat or keeping jobs alive. You know, we are at the stage of the crisis where we should be thinking much more about, it doesn't have to be build back better, which is, you know, such an overused expression, but just to be thinking more about helping economy grow rather than just holding it in suspended animation, keeping it afloat.
Okay, towards the end of the call, I want to come to a bit about Harry and Meghan, specifically Divided Nation. But before I do that, two very short questions for you, Annalise, because we've had them come through. First one, question for Annalise, how would a Labour government protect and promote the City of London? That's from Simon Lyon.
I will be very, very quick on this. I mean, I think this is a much broader question than just the city, because one in 14 jobs in the UK actually is in the field of financial and related professional services. So we really do need to do much more. I view the sector as a critical element of that missing industrial strategy, actually. It's an area where, you know, we have excelled previously, where we don't have a clear skills strategy, we don't have a clear regional strategy, and we need to have both, as well as a commitment above all to making sure that we keep that strong reputation for, you know, always ensuring that a contract that's concluded in the UK will always be followed, that regulation is always watertight, that there can be confidence in the legal context. I think that's very, very important for the sector going forward, as well as, of course, us having that positive relationship with the EU27 when it comes to trade. And we still don't have that memorandum of understanding that, of course, is promised in order to provide that context for financial and related professional services.
And a very specific question from USS Annalise. What are your views on Lord Hill's recommendations following his review on the listing rules? Do you think it's a good idea that we potentially dilute some of our corporate governance standards, such as one share, one vote, to attract tech companies to the UK?
Well, I think it's very important that those measures are time limited. I mean, he has said that there will be, you know, a cutoff after which we'll see a move into more normal practice, because actually, you know, shareholder activism, so-called, I think, has been often a positive mechanism for corporate change, you know, in a whole variety of different directions. So I think it's positive that they're short term. I would say there's some other measures within his recommendations that we're looking at very carefully. I mean, for example, around some of the new vehicles that might be easier to create under Hill's proposed regime, which might not necessarily have the transparency that we would want to see. And, you know, again, I see the amount of transparency in the activities of our, you know, stock exchange, of the city more generally, as the UK's financial and related professional services. So we, you know, we don't want to be reaching for gimmicks rather than focusing on the long-term prospects of that industry.
Okay, that's helpful. So as we come to the final few minutes, let's take on the small subject of the divided nation that Deborah brought up. Deborah, give us a bit more of a clue into, when you scratch more than scratching the surface, about how split the country is, and particularly on the issue of how we come out of lockdown and what kind of society we have in terms of work, et cetera, afterwards.
Well, funny enough, I don't know if the nation is that divided on that specific point. You know, all the way through, we've been pretty consistent that we've prioritised health over the economy, that we've been much more concerned. I mean, there's been a majority always in favour, actually, of harsher lockdown than the government has proposed. And I don't see, for all people's frustrations with where we currently are and longing to get out of, you know, this weird life that we're all living, I don't really see any change to that. So in terms of the future, I think that, you know, there possibly is more consistency. I think that the divide is much more about the sort of values that underpin what we do rather than literally what we do. And that, you know, we saw that first playing out with Brexit. And, you know, that was about whether or not you saw Britain's position in the global world as being important, or whether you were, you know, looking at, if you like, a more old-fashioned version of Britain. That divide was again an age divide, which also correlates with an education divide, because, you know, the older you are, the less likely you are to be a graduate, the younger you are, the more highly educated you are. But then there are a whole bunch of other sort of social cultural attitudes that tend to attach themselves to those. So, you know, Lord Ashcroft did a really interesting piece of work that I quote again and again and again immediately after the Brexit vote. I always call it the isms poll, where he asked people whether a whole bunch of isms, things like feminism, globalism, liberalism, were a force for good or a force for evil. And it cut down the middle. And it was about, you know, it correlated with leave or remain. And it was about your view of modern Britain and what it ought to look like. And I think we're seeing that played out again with Harry and Meghan, if you like, Harry and Meghan versus the Queen.
And just quickly on that, I mean, it's very easy to sort of break it down to young versus old, metropolitan versus provincial. Is it as simple as that?
It sort of is. I mean, no, it isn't quite as simple as that. So, for example, in those red wall seats that I now know very well, one of the interesting things was that the young people there tended to have attitudes that were more like the older people there. So in other words, young people who had stayed in a place like Accrington or Stoke or whatever tended to have more in common in their views with older people. The big difference was they were actually less likely to vote at all, but if they did vote, they would be more likely to vote like older people, and their value set seemed to be more like, because the younger people who didn't share those values had moved to the you know, to the urban environment, moved to the city.
And Stephanie, a lot of people feel that in lockdown, we've had a chance to look at how much business and society was obsessed by efficiency and, you know, squeezing every last drop out of everything. And a lot of people have reflected on that, thought, well, maybe that's not how we want to live anymore. Any thoughts about on that from the economist's point of view?
I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I do wonder whether we will all have those same thoughts. You know, we're also all desperate to go back out shopping and back to all the things we were doing before. So we may underestimate that feeling of self-improvement that comes out of this. But I think in terms of the broader economy, I think, you know, the plus side to some of these conversations about how the economy's changed and potentially business models changing, is that we have, you know, for economists who've been waiting, you know, since you and I were at the BBC, we've been waiting for productivity growth, and I would be on the 10 o'clock news trying to say, why has there not been more productivity growth in the UK? You know, we may globally and in the UK have a bit of a burst on that in some of these sectors where it's hardest to get productivity growth, namely the services sector, public sector. You know, we were talking about nurses' wages the other day, but it, you know, the GPs have responded extraordinarily efficiently, and that bit of the health system, and they have moved overnight to telemedicine in a way that we hadn't thought was possible, and I don't think that's going to change. So I think there are positive things. I'm not, as I say, I'm a bit more sceptical of whether we're all going to become better people as a result of this with all the right values, and but I do think that there will be, that we've already seen a step change in the way businesses work in some of these sectors that actually could be quite valuable for us long term. And the public services, actually, crucially, very important.
Thank you. Annalise, I just want to give you the last word. I mean, it's a political party, you want to try and speak for the entire nation. We haven't even mentioned Scotland yet, but let's gloss over that one. But you want to try and speak for the whole nation, but it feels like there's lots of division, and also a sense in which people maybe do want it to be a bit different after lockdown as well. Just give us your thoughts on that and we'll bring it to a close.
I mean, I think the really important thing not to lose sight of is actually what we have achieved. I think that's absolutely critical, and it's been through very often working together, and actually, you know, the private sector has been critical to that. Different businesses of all sizes, you know, whether it's the pub down the road from me who helped old people get their food and that kind of thing during the first lockdown, or indeed the ventilator challenge. I went to North Wales and saw what had been achieved there. Absolutely incredible. I mean, mind-blowing stuff. And I think it's very important we don't then lose that capacity. You know, the fact we work together and we achieve those incredible things, I wouldn't want us to be losing that capacity for the future, because it does mean we'll be able to face future crises far better if we learn from what worked. And it was that working together that I think was the most positive and indeed productive element.
Thank you for that. And thank you to the entire panel. That was fantastic discussion. I mean, we were dealing with some vast topics, but I certainly was fascinating as well. I'd like to give my thanks to Annalise, Deborah and Stephanie. You were all great. I'd like you to imagine the virtual round of applause and standing ovation that is going on, and say thank you very much, and thank you to our audience as well. We'll be back shortly and be out to tell you who our panel are going to be next time, very soon. But in the meantime, thank you, everyone, and thank you to a great panel.